You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places and the rings of Southern California. I'm Steve Chitakis. You ever dream of being in one of those fantasy shows? Fighting alongside Jon Snow on Game of Thrones or sitting around the round table with King Arthur? Well, there's a growing community of warrior hopefuls who put on that armor and use real weapons to live out that fantasy. Whoever said dress-up was only for playing pretend? Those are the sounds of two men beating each other up for real, out of love for all things mighty and medieval. They call themselves knights, knights with a K, competing in the sport of medieval steel fighting. They also want you to call them athletes.
So this kind of has its roots in nerddom and Renaissance fairs, but the sport of medieval fighting is rigorous.
That's Jay Brooks, who founded a knight fighting league in the United States about 7 years ago. Hasn't been big here in California yet, but he's hoping to bring the sport across the nation to all the men and women who dream of one day fighting under honor of the Knights Code. KCRW's Jerome Campbell caught up with a group of these modern knights on a recent weekend in Long Beach at the convention center, where they brawled for an audience.
This looks nothing like a Renaissance fair, and more like a WWE match. The ring is cordoned off with those metal crowd control fences you see at concert venues. There's a mat and a rack of weapons ringside. There's the same level of showmanship, too.
We have Marcus Leo Kelly, the fourth, in the black. And we have Jake Schultz in the green brigandine.
Both men are dressed in metal suits of armor, hearkening back to the noblemen of the 15th and 16th century, because league rules require authentic period dress. The battle begins with two men circling around the ring. A few strikes of the armor, a parry, then they circle again. An audience of about 50 people and a few bodybuilders cheer them on. But then, someone takes a longsword to the head. And things get real.
What the hell, dude? Hit him again, right in the head. Oh! In the bread basket.
If you notice, like, my tactics are to kind of sneak in. Like, I waited until the opponents got in. And then I got two very decisive hits. All it takes is one hit for me if I place it right.
That's Jake Schultz. He's been involved in knight fighting for about 3 years. He's just won his first battle of the day. And in a show of chivalry, he helps his opponent off the ground. Because today, he is not living out his day job as a camera assistant. Instead, he is a knight. And these are his people.
I think everybody in the league were people who did similar things, you know, fighting with sticks or fighting with, like, foam weapons or some of that. But we were always that one friend that, like, took it too far and nobody wanted to fight against. And so finally, everybody across the country and the world created one sport and one league where we can all do that and everything's fine. You can go as hard as you want and nothing's held back.
Nowadays, with Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and Conan and all the popular culture that has, you know, spread around the country, and, you know, it's part of our popular culture now. These are things that were all nerd things at one time. Now it's ours.
That's Jay Brooks, the evangelist for this sport who we just met a few minutes ago. The Armored Combat Sports League he started now has 1,000 members. Brooks began his knighthood fantasy at the age of 16, fighting at medieval reenactments, sort of like Renaissance festivals. These battles used foam and wooden weapons and were mostly theatrical. But then, in 2011, someone showed him a video of Russian fantasy knights who had a modern take on it, real forged weapons. And he got hooked.
Where has this been my whole life? This is steel weapons, and they're kicking, and they're grappling, and they're tackling each other from behind. And basically, it's about as physical as humans can be with each other without killing each other.
And once a year, there was a world championship match at a real castle in Europe. So he gathered a team of American knights to compete in Poland and won several duels.
For centuries, knights fought in armor.
Then the History Channel caught wind of these battles and created a show around it called Knight Fights.
Six fighters, bearing armor and history's deadliest weapons.
All that attention led the league to grow from Jay's home state of New Hampshire to all over the country. His most recent effort has been right here in Long Beach, where he plans to have a competition next year.
We've got a whole bunch of different sports. We've got longsword and polearm and sword and shield, and then we've got our different melee sports, and we've got it in men's and women's categories and open categories, and we're just scratching the tip of it.
Now, the rules of these battles are pretty straightforward. In one-on-one duels, you can strike your opponent for points. But in the big brawls, you want to knock them out. And that's where the battle becomes a lot less chivalrous. Anything goes, except stabbing. Here's Jake Schultz again.
Like in a tournament situation, if I'm running up on somebody behind, I'm going to hit them right in the butt where there's no armor. Because there's a lot of meat there, you're not going to break any bones. It hurts terribly and they're going to go down instantly and they're going to be limping for the rest of the tournament.
Brian Sherloff is a 50-year-old knight who has been in the sport for about a year. He's already in pretty good shape, but the nearly 100 pounds of armor and gear has been a challenge, especially the helmet.
The main reason is it's harder to breathe. You're wearing a helmet that has very, very limited airflow. So unless you control your breathing, you're going to be breathing in your own CO2, which is going to make you dizzy. It's going to make you fatigued.
Back at the ring, Jake is fighting his last duel of the day against a towering knight clad in all black armor. And Jake is already losing his breath after the first round. He seems to outmaneuver his opponent with several strikes, but can't bring him down. Then, in the last round, right as their weapons lock, Jake uses his shield to punch his opponent in the face. And the man in black crumbles to the ground. Jake raises his arms in triumph and takes in the adulation of the crowd. He knows it can turn on a dime. He knows, on any other day, it could be him lying dazed on the ground. Because when two knights go to battle, the sword can truly cut both ways. For KCRW, I'm Jerome Campbell.
Well, from brawling knights to old-fashioned street fights over market share.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway.
Speaking of highway, Ford Motor Company was in town last night, in Hawthorne, actually, just down the street from Tesla.
Please join me in welcoming the Mach-E, the latest addition to the Mustang stable.
But
isn't it gorgeous?
Isn't it gorgeous? It's not only a new generation of Mustang, though. It's also Ford's entry into the long-range electric vehicle market. And they're using the iconic Mustang nameplate in what is actually a crossover four-door SUV. Aaron Robinson is editor-at-large for Hagerty Magazine. He's here to talk more about it. Hello, Aaron.
Very happy to be here.
A four-door crossover electric SUV with a Mustang nameplate. It's got the little horsey, too.
Yes.
Why Mustang? What's the thinking there?
Well, Ford is behind in electric vehicle efforts. It's one of the reasons they brought Jim Hackett in a few years ago because he had deep ties in the Silicon Valley. They formed this thing called Team Edison to work on advanced projects. They bought the Michigan Central Station, which is in downtown Detroit, this crumbling facade building that was going to now become the center of their tech campus. And they were working on this electric kind of Ford focused wagon thing. And Jim Farley, who's an ex-Toyota guy, who's now president of their new business and tech strategy, he comes in and he says, "Nah, that's not going to work. Make it like a Mustang." And so they made it look like a Mustang. And eventually they talked themselves into calling it the Mustang and giving it that title, which I personally think is kind of a short-term strategy. It makes a big bang now, which with when your stock's at $9 a share, that's what you want. It sounds like you're taking Tesla head on. But in fact, now you have Mustang, the sporty car, tied to this electric crossover in the marketplace. The two have to have similar styling. They have to be marketed the same. It's kind of a short-term strategy.
It doesn't really look like a Mustang, though. Maybe on the back end it does?
Yeah, the taillights and the face.
Yeah.
Another one in between is this kind of, it's a nice-looking, five-door crossover vehicle, but...
It looks like a Tesla, actually, is what it looks like.
Well, and honestly, I mean, that's the thing. Tesla has really shaken up the car industry. There's now this thing called the Tesla effect in the industry, which is affecting resale values on BMW 3 Series and Audi A4s, and it's kind of some of the standard bearers in that class. They're going to show us a pickup truck on Thursday. They've really shaken up the industry. And so, and when they announced the Model 3 and they had hundreds of thousands of orders, people, you know, at regular car companies, other car companies, at their board meetings, people would yell at them, "Well, how come when you introduce a car, nobody said, you know, you don't get 100,000, 300,000 signups?" And so it's really affected the industry.
We'll get to the pickup truck, the Tesla pickup truck, in just a moment. But this is an electric long-range automobile, the Ford Mustang Mach-E, a range of more than 250 miles on a full charge, a sticker that'll be just under $60,000. So how does that compare to a Tesla or other electric cars out there?
Well, they're doing it similar to Tesla. They're taking online orders for a $500 deposit. There's going to be two versions at launch. There's this premium edition at $51,700, then a first edition at $61,000. And as did Tesla, the cheaper versions with less range will come out later. So these will be over 300 miles range initially, then at about 240 miles range at about $45,000. Of course, there's going to be government incentives. There's a federal tax credit that maxes out at $7,500. Now, California's just changed their rules. They're making it income-based, so you get less money the more money you make. You get less money back as a EV buyer. So the rebates are going to vary depending on who you are.
I mentioned the fact, Aaron, that Ford's curtain raiser happened last night right down the street from Elon Musk's Hawthorne headquarters. Obviously deliberate, kind of a shot across the bow. Does Ford see this new electric Mustang as a direct competitor to Tesla?
Yeah, I think they do, and I think everybody else does too. And that's how they want it to be seen, because again, there's huge excitement about Tesla, especially on Wall Street. Their stock again is stratospheric. GM stock went up hugely when Mary Barra started to talk about electric vehicles. Wall Street likes talk about the future, about electric vehicles. It can't just be about selling pickup trucks anymore. The F-150 is a Fortune 50 company, just that one product, but that's not enough to get Wall Street excited. So now it's like make a big bang and seem to be taking on Tesla head on, and that's how you attract Wall Street's attention.
And Tesla's making a pickup truck that it's unveiling on Thursday in Hawthorne. Is that potentially a big deal for this company and for the prospect of more electric vehicles on the road? I mean, Tesla's had a bumpy ride.
Right. Well, absolutely. I mean, the Cybertruck or the Cyberpunk truck, which is what Elon called it in a tweet. Tesla's starting to flesh out its product line, which is something that, you know, fully mature car companies do. And the problem with Tesla is that they're really good at making the computer. They're not good at making the box that the computer comes in, which is something that Ford is very good at doing. They're really good at making the box, maybe not so good at the computers. So, you know, Tesla, when the Model 3 is basically like a three generations ago Kia with F-35 technology below the floor, and or cell phone technology. And the idea that, you know, a car company can't compete.
Kia?
Yeah, well, it's basically anybody who makes cars for a living would laugh at the Model 3 just purely from the car itself. The technology below the floor, the electronics, the batteries, is way ahead.
Yeah.
But the cars, meantime, you have Ford, who's actually very good at making cars, is now trying to come into their space, as is Porsche, as is pretty much everybody else. Everybody is gunning for Tesla.
With the big screen on the inside, right, as the
with
dashboard.
With a 15.5-inch screen in that Mach-E. It's a big, big TV set.
Tesla has one factory, though, right? Here in California, in Fremont.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah. And ironically, the Mach-E is going to be made in the old Fiesta plant in Mexico. Ford has now stopped making cars, or they've said they're going to stop making cars. This is a case of an SUV actually killing off a small car, because it's going to be made in that same plant in Mexico where the Fiesta used to be made.
Wow. Aaron Robinson, editor-at-large for Hagerty Magazine. Well, it's going to be exciting to see, though. A lot of cars coming out.
It never ends in the auto industry.
Aaron, thanks. Well, coming up, we're going to talk more about what happens when you die. That obituary lasts a long time. Mo Rock is in to talk more about how he'd like to rethink some obituaries. Mobituaries, next on Greater LA. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. And now, the end of the show. We are at peace with what we've done with our program. Our families have given us the support and adulation we really, really needed. We thank the universe for our production lives, but now we're headed to the other side. Please join hands with the person next to you. Sorry about being so macabre, and no, this really isn't the funeral for our show, but have you ever wondered what your funeral will be like? What people will say about you when you're gone? Mo Rocca knows a thing or two about words spoken about the dearly departed because he hosts the Mobituaries podcast and has written a book called Mobituaries, Great Lives Worth Reliving. He's also a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning, host of Innovation Nation, and longtime panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Death becomes you, by the way.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Why write about obituaries and how people are remembered?
I think that there are people that didn't get the send-off they deserved the first time. And I think that there are people that, even household names, people that are still famous, like a Sammy Davis Jr. or a Marlena Dietrich, I think aren't remembered maybe in the way that they should be. And there are people that were never celebrated. And things and beliefs don't get obituaries.
We are creatures of putting things in boxes, right? We prefer black and white to sort of the nuanced gray. So what happens is a person is remembered in a certain way, right? They're remembered and that becomes sort of the permanent way.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of messiness. I do think that there's a tendency. We only have so much in this overused word bandwidth, but that's to the detriment of how people are remembered. Like somebody like a Billy Carter is remembered as a joke. And
Billy Beer.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And Dan Rather told me even the dogs wouldn't drink it.
Oh.
Because it really was bad. But Billy Carter was a complicated, funny, hardworking guy. I talked to President Jimmy Carter about him. And he was also an alcoholic who in the last chapter of his life went around the country talking to people who could relate to him about their own struggles with alcoholism. So he was a full human being. Of course he was.
Is there anything, any story from your book that stood out to you about Los Angeles, about Southern California?
The story of Lois Weber is an interesting one to me. She was the first woman to direct a feature film in 1914. She directed a version of The Merchant of Venice. And her name was really said in the same breath as D.W. Griffith and Cecil B. DeMille in early Hollywood. In 1 year, she directed 10 short films. She was the first to use a split screen. It was really a triptych in a movie called Suspicion. She acted in a lot of the movies as well. But she was a very, very big deal until she was forgotten. But that aspect of Los Angeles in the film industry was so interesting to me that there were no rules yet. So anyone who had the drive and the talent could do it. And then when Hollywood became big business and the banks took over, then I imagine like the Monopoly guy with the cigar chomper coming in and saying kind of like, ladies, step aside. This is now real business.
She could also be painted as a little unsavory as well because of her beliefs.
Well, she had been an evangelist.
Yeah.
She brought her proselytizing to film. She made a movie called Where Are My Children that actually my mother was watching the other day and was kind of riveted by on TCM. Yeah. They showed it. It essentially espoused eugenics, the idea that white, upwardly mobile, middle-class white women should not be getting abortions, that abortions should be for the poor and for women of color. But it should be said that her beliefs were typical of the day. They were not atypical.
But is that an example of we remember her for that? Like she never renounced that. She never said, you know, no, I really don't believe this.
Well, I don't think she's remembered at all, which I think is the larger, for me, the larger point is that, you know, I'm interested in these little pockets of history. They're almost like they seem like Camelot, like mythical periods, but they really existed where there were women doing a lot in this case in Hollywood and had power in Hollywood in this very early period. Is it more Camelot or is it more Brigadoon?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I love my musicals, but like, you know, I think both could
Oklahoma,
work here.
Maybe Oklahoma? No.
Not Oklahoma, though. I love Oklahoma. I mean, Agnes DeMille. Well, I mean, I want to do an obituary on Agnes DeMille.
Really? Yeah. Is that next? Is that the sequel?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Everything's up to date in Kansas City. Sorry, this is not Greater Kansas City. They gone about as far as they can go.
This is Greater LA. Sammy Davis Jr., you mentioned, right? Yeah. Now, there's someone who, again, nobody really thinks about these days, right? Like, he's been gone a while.
Sammy Davis Jr. was interesting to me because he represents not just the passing of an extraordinary talent, of a quintuple threat, actor, singer, dancer, impressionist, a gun spinner, right? And in all those things...
Rat Pack.
Right. And in all those things, he's better pretty much than anyone else. I mean, there's this light from within. But he represented the end of a kind of entertainment. Like, I think a lot of people now think wouldn't call themselves an entertainer. They would think, oh, that's sort of cheesy. What I admire about Sammy Davis Jr. is that there was nothing ironic about him. He never made fun of the material, and he always elevated it. Like, you can go on YouTube and you can find him singing the theme song to Chico and the Man or to Maude, and you're going to roll your eyes back. But then when you hear it, you go, my God, he's totally committed. And that takes a kind of bravery, I think. It's remarkable. He died on the same day as Jim Henson. I'm very interested in people who died on the same day, just because I think it sort of highlights the randomness of life and death.
Jim Henson probably got the bigger, the more notoriety.
You know, I actually have a Google Doc that my producer, Megan Marcus, put together of, and they sort of split most front pages, as opposed to Michael and Farrah. When Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett died, Michael Jackson dominated the headlines. When Mohandas Gandhi and Orville Wright died on the same day, Mahatma Gandhi got the banner headline because he'd been assassinated, and India had only been independent for about a year. And Orville Wright lived 45 years past the flight at Kitty Hawk. So
you're really in your element right now, by the way.
Thank you so much. I'm feeling it. I'm in the moment right now.
He has no notes, by the way. Nothing. It's just coming right out of his brain.
Right. And Orson Welles and Yul Brynner dying on the same day, of course. And, of course, Annette Funicello and Margaret Thatcher dying on the same day. And I like to imagine kind of a weird Freaky Friday reboot where they switch places in the afterlife.
Ooh.
And Maggie Thatcher stars in How to Stuff a Wild Bikini.
Chilling Skippy Peanut Butter.
Right. Exactly. Right. That's right. Yeah. Skippy. That was Annette Funicello. You're right.
It sure was. Right. The Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah. What was the question?
I want to talk about some politicians in California as well. There was a former governor of California.
Romualdo Pacheco.
Yeah.
So I'm interested. I think it's interesting. Look, most Californians know that California used to be part of Mexico. But this, you know, I think that most Californians, if you said who was the first Mexican-American governor of California, would say, what are you talking about? There hasn't been one. There actually was one. Romualdo Pacheco was what's known as a Californio, which is a word I love, which means that he was one of the landed gentry of the California territory before it was part of the United States. Mm-hmm. So he's a Californio. Very few people get to call themselves a Californio.
Like a politico? Is that what that is?
Yeah, it's a name, like a Californio. I mean, I just love
Angelino.
Right.
Right.
But he was a Californio. It's like
I've never heard that term.
Yeah,
before.
Yeah. And he became not only the first Hispanic member of the House of Representatives of the U.S. Congress, he was also governor of California at one point. And so the cyclical nature of history is very interesting to me, because surely there will once again be a Mexican-American governor of California at some point.
Does it get depressing talking about dead people?
No.
Do people ask you that?
Okay, I'm going to give you a canned answer right now. I've been working on this one. Tell me how this goes over. If you're feeling anxiety in the present about the future, the past is a great place to be.
Oh.
I don't know. It's a little
You're saying we shouldn't live in the past.
I'm saying that the past is not an escape. I think the past gives us context, and I think it can give us reassurance. And I also, by the way, highly recommend dealing with dead people. They're very easy to deal with. Dead people don't have publicists. They don't have writers.
Well,
they have estates. That's true sometimes.
They certainly do.
Yes, that is true. I don't find it morbid, and I don't find it stressful, because I think everybody wants to be memorialized in some way. And they don't. We're all going to be forgotten, but it would be nice if people remembered us for just a little bit.
And the right way, the way you want them to remember you.
Yeah.
And not necessarily the way that sort of, you know, the permanence of
Listen, Steve, I don't want to be remembered as a screen siren. I want to be remembered for my 18 months at the front during World War II, you know, performing for 5 servicemen in a foxhole with howitzers flying overhead. Sorry, that's Marlena Dietrich, but you get my point.
Exactly. Mo Rocca, who wrote the book Mobituaries, has the podcast Two Great Lives Worth Reliving. Mo, my condolences.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Do you want me to send flowers or food?
I have to think about that for a second. Definitely food. Send food, Mo. That's it for today. Tomorrow, LA's newest homeless shelter is quite the educating experience. Next on KCRW, it's The Business with Kim Masters. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Not only can you subscribe to the podcast, little yellow icon there, just click it. You can also share your thoughts with us there as well. Jenna Cagle, PJ Shahamat, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen each and every day, and so do you. Thank you for your time and for your ear. I'm Steve Chiatakis on this Monday. Have a great day.